Straight out of Scotland, this is the Reluctant Theologian Podcast. I am your host, Dr. R.T. Mullins from the University of St. Andrews. Many people believe that there's a close connection between consciousness and the brain. Yet the human brain is still somewhat of a mystery to us. For example, we still know very little about the early stages of human brain development. Recently, scientists have started growing these little things called brain organoids to help them understand how human brains grow and develop. In today's episode, I sit down with the neurobiologist John Mason to discuss his work on brain organoids and chat about some of the potential philosophical implications. If you have questions or topics that you would like to hear on the show, you can send me a message at rtmullins.com. Well, ready or not, here I am, picking John's brain. Enjoy. All right, so John, thank you for being here today. Could you just start by telling us a bit about your research?
Okay, so what I'm interested in really, and what we've been trying to work out in my lab, is to understand how the brain normally develops during embryogenesis. And this process has kind of fascinated me for a long time, because I find it kind of really amazing that something as complicated as a brain will develop over the course of, in the mouse, literally days. In the human, weeks or months.
Wow,
that
okay.
This extraordinarily complex structure gets put together in a relatively short period of time
right.
In embryogenesis. And it has all these very sophisticated functions and lots of different cells, and they're all organized. And just this very, very complex structure is somehow able to arise very, very reproducibly so quickly. And I'd love to be able to understand biologically how that process unravel. So that's what I've been trying to work out. And that's important partly because it's an interesting biological question. So I'm driven, honestly, largely by intellectual curiosity. I would love to understand how that works, and that's probably the primary motivation. But the other thing about this is that if we understand normal brain development, then that helps us understand neurodevelopmental disorders. So there are disorders like autism, and there are syndromes which are caused by mutations in genes which we know regulate how the brain develops. That if we can understand normal brain development, then that puts us in a much better position to understand what goes wrong when a neurodevelopmental disorder arises. And in the fullness of time, the hope is that would help us to allow us to design strategies to help people who are affected by these disorders and their families and so on.
Right.
So I'm not talking about curing autism or anything like that,
sure.
But going in that kind of direction. So driven really primarily by the basic science, but,
yeah.
But being aware that it has clear applications in understanding.
Right. So the motivation for you to get into this was originally, well, I mean, it's just such a surprising complexity in such a short time span, right?
Yes.
And then the applications later on, I mean, that's a really nice benefit if you can figure some of these issues out. Okay, so that's some of what you're doing right now. So one of the stuff I want to talk about here is brain development. And so it's somewhat remarkable because it's a self-organization process in which cells proliferate, they differentiate, they migrate, and they wire to form all these like functional neural circuits. And before we're jumping into something called this brain in a dish model, I think we should briefly mention how the brain develops in humans, because you mentioned a bit about rats, you mentioned a bit about humans. So with regards to humans, do we know every single step in the developmental process here, or are we missing some of the steps?
So the short answer to that is no, we do not know any single step. So actually there are very important gaps in our knowledge, particularly in human brain development. So there are obvious practical and ethical constraints with doing any kind of work with human embryos.
Sure.
So for that reason, scientists have had to use animal models. We've had to use model systems, and animals are the most commonly used model, and the most commonly used animal is mouse. So for many years, we've used mice because we can genetically modify the mice. We can add genes in and take genes away. We can manipulate the mice in a way that is not ever going to be possible with a human embryo. So we can design experiments to help us understand the genes and the circuits that control these developmental processes. You can study human development to some extent because the embryos become available for research purposes, and you can do a lot of descriptive work with those, and people have done observational and descriptive work. And what we found from that is that actually one of the assumptions which underlies the animal work is a bit oversimple. So we've used the mouse as the most accessible available model to try to understand brain development. But as we've learned a bit about human, we've learned that there are, unsurprisingly actually, that there are significant differences between how the human brain develops and how the mouse brain develops. And in particular, there are classes of cells which are present in the human brain which are either absent or at vanishingly low levels in the mouse. So, so there are whole aspects of human biology, human brain development biology, that we can't study in the mouse. And that's where the organoid system comes in, because it allows us actually to grow human embryonic brain-like tissue in vitro in a way that we can analyze and examine it. And it's a, arguably, I mean, it's still early days with this, but it's arguably a better model for understanding early human brain development than an animal model is.
Okay, so with an animal model, it's somewhat simplified. So it gives you a nice toy model, but you're saying it, it's missing some steps, and so that's why you would you think human organoids would be sort of the way forward, because it'll help you understand some of those missing steps.
Yeah,
because so it's not as simplified as a mouse.
Yeah, so we've learned a lot from the mouse. So the basic setup of how the particularly at the early stages, I think that the basic way that the brain develops in the embryo is similar. So, I mean, that makes sense because these things have evolved.
Right.
So they've evolved from a common ancestor and the mechanism stays the same and gets varied in the different species. And obviously humans have evolved a very much larger brain than mice have, and a much more sophisticated structure. And there are extra steps in making it. So we understand a lot about early stages of brain development from studying mouse, and we can probably extrapolate that to human. But there are clearly important differences between how mouse and human brains develop. That means that the mouse is an imperfect model.
Okay. So from what I understand, there's a lot of history here. And so since 1952, scientists have been, I guess, just sort of fiddling with cells and the way they self-organize in order to make this shift to like an in vitro study of the developmental neurobiology here. Now, but then there was this thing in 2001, and there was the first transplantable neuroprecursors for human embryonic stem cells, and these were made in 2001. And so this led to a series of milestones which allowed some people in the Madeline Lancaster group in 2013 to generate the first complex human brain organoids. And so that's something you've already mentioned a minute ago, these brain organoids. So how do scientists build organoids in the lab, and from which cells do we start?
Organoids are built from stem cells, and the stem cells that we use are called pluripotent stem cells, or induced pluripotent stem cells. And these are made from cells that are already specialized. So we can take a skin biopsy from a human, a child or an adult, and we can genetically change those cells in a way that drives them back into a stem cell fate. So although it's become a specialized cell, we can change it to make it into a stem cell. So the beauty of that is that there's no embryonic involvement or anything. We're taking adult tissue, and we are using this clever system developed by Tanaka in Japan to derive an embryonic-like stem cell that can differentiate into any. So these are remarkable cells, and they can differentiate into any cell, any differentiated cell type that.
Oh, because that's what it means, that they're pluripotent.
Or pluripotent. So they have many potentials, so they can develop into lots of different cells, including all of the different cell types that are present in the brain, as far as we know. So we use these, and then actually making the organoid is surprisingly simple. So Madeline Lancaster was one of the key people in this, and she published some really beautiful work in Nature in 2013, which was the one, I think, that really brought the idea of organoids to the attention of the community. And also, importantly, Yoshiki Sasai in Japan did a lot of the groundwork, first with mouse and then with human. And he really was one of the people, probably the key pioneer in the field, actually, in realizing that these cells had the potential to self-organize to the extent that they could make actual bits of tissue. And people have made organoids from tissues other than brain, but the brain stuff, yeah. So the I'm interested in is the brain, so I'll talk about brain organoids.
Sure,
We'll stick with that.
So you can make lots of organoids, they can make like a lung or anything, but the brain's what you're working on.
So there are people in the building who make kidney organoids, for example.
Okay.
And others who make from the gut and the intestine and liver and pretty much any tissue that you're interested in.
Oh, wow, okay.
So that just indicates the pluripotentiality of the stem cells.
Right.
You can make all these different types of tissues from the same starting material.
Right.
So to make a brain organoid from iPSCs, all you have to do is to take them a few thousand of them, allow them to kind of stick together in a dish, and then leave them more or less to their own devices. There are one or two factors that we have to add that makes things a bit better, and we give them a sort of gel-like substance that allows them to stick together and probably gives them a sort of stimulus to growth. And then we leave them, we shake them so that the gases can get in and out of the organoid and nutrients can pass in and out, so that the what's best if the medium is agitated a bit. But really, we're not adding too much to them. And part of that is because it seems to be that brain, a particular type of brain neuron, is kind of the default fate for a stem cell. So if all you have to do to make it into a brain is to stop it becoming something else. So these dorsal forebrain neurons seem to be the default fate of stem cells, including iPSCs. So growing them is relatively straightforward. It's really a surprisingly simple protocol, and that's the cells have the ability to self-organize. So the different cell types will arise within the tissue, and then they will organize within the tissue. And we see these beautiful patterns of different types of specialized cells arranged in the same pattern as we would see in an embryo.
Okay, so I want to make sure I'm following along. So you're able to take some of these pluripotent cells and just put them in the right sort of environment and just kind of let it go on its own, and they turn into a brain organoid.
Pretty much,
yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, there's a most simplified way.
There's a little bit to it, but basically, in a nutshell, that's it. It's really a very straightforward protocol.
Okay, so this leads to another question here. So how is it possible that brain organoids can differentiate into various neural tissue types? Because I'm assuming there's quite a lot going on here.
Right, so the brain has a lot of different subregions within it. So we're interested in one particular region, which is the cerebral cortex, which is the big foldy bit on the outside, which is where all the higher order cognitive functions and so on reside. So a lot of our work is focused on making that, and also on making another part called the thalamus, which sits in the center of the brain, and that receives sensory information coming in from the periphery and so on. So if you're making cortex, that's relatively easy to do. So kind of almost as if it was a default fate for the stem cells,
is that
they will become cortical neurons. If we want to make different regions of the brain, then we have to add signals to them to promote that different type of differentiation. And that work is guided by what I'm talking about earlier, which is the animal models. So because we understand from animal models that there are signaling molecules which are present in the embryo and around the embryo that give instructions to cells to adopt a particular fate, then we can take these signals and we can add them at a particular concentration, at a particular time, for a particular length, to the developing cells, and that will guide them to form a different tissue or a different region of the brain or whatever. So the cells have the potential to become any of these things, and we can steer them a bit by controlling the factors that we subject them to.
Okay, so you learn quite a bit from the mouse model in order to actually figure out how to build these brain organoids. Yeah. Okay, so that sounds like it was really useful in a way that I'm assuming that wasn't the plan when people were originally studying mouse cells and mouse brains, was how do we build a human brain from this?
It seems like a nice side effect. It was informed by what I said back at the beginning, which is that people wanted to understand how the brain develops. You can't study human brain development. Let's use the best available experimental tool, which is the mouse.
Yeah.
And that's what people use. But the hope was the same, was that by understanding what happened in the mouse, then we could understand normal development and neurodevelopmental disorders.
Right.
And it becomes difficult because there are substantial differences between mouse brains and human brains.
Right.
Some types of neurodevelopmental disorders, you can take a gene which will have a very severe effect on a human brain, mutate that gene in the mouse, and the mouse is pretty normal. There are cases where the mouse has a very severe phenotype, and we've learned about the actions of important developmental regulatory genes in the mouse, but it's not always the case. So the argument for using the mouse was the same as the argument for using the organoid. It's a tool which is available to allow us to address the same kind of questions.
Yeah. Okay, so there's another question that I want to get into here. So how long does it take to build a brain organoid? And then also, how long do you keep the brain organoid in a dish?
Right, so it varies a bit. So one of the interesting things to me is that a lot of the information is the cells have their own intrinsic information. So when we started making the organoids, we were growing them from mouse cells. And as I say, a mouse embryo, the normal time of gestation is about 3 weeks. So the brain develops across about 10, 12, 14 days of that. And the mouse ES cells, stem cells, will make a mouse organoid in that kind of time scale. The human ones, a human brain obviously takes up to about 9 months in utero to develop. And similarly, the organoids develop in a much slower, so there's an internal clock in the mm-hmm. cells that they know what species they're from. So mouse ones we can make in a couple of weeks. The human ones will grow over a period of weeks to months.
Okay.
Specifically, what we're interested in, and I think where organoids are very good and most likely to be useful, is looking at the earliest stages of mouse development. So of brain development. Mm-hmm. So at the stages where the different regions of the brain get set up and the first types of neurons are born and different types of neurons are born in different parts, and then they have to migrate and then they have to make connections and so on. So I think that those early stages are the things that are most likely to be, we're most likely to get an insight into from using organoids. So the organoids that we're growing, we're keeping them for 90 to 120 days, the human ones. Other people in other groups around the world are more interested in the mature electrically active neurons, and they take longer, like quite a lot longer, to develop. So people have kept organoids in culture tissues for 9 months or 12 months or sometimes even longer than that.
Okay, so you said you keep them up to around 90 days, and then the other groups keep them up to about a year or so?
Yeah.
Okay. So we've mentioned a few times that there's clear differences between mouse brains and human brains. And so now I guess I'm kind of curious about what's the difference between a brain organoid and a human brain.
Right, okay. So the human brain, so as I said right at the beginning, this is an extraordinarily complex structure.
Right. Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's got all these different regions with different functions. It's got an enormous number of neurons in it, and they're organized in a very specific way, and there are very specific patterns of connections between different parts of the brain. So what gives the brain its enormous kind of cognitive ability and processing power and so on is the spectacular number of precise connections that are made. And many of these connections are set up initially during embryogenesis, so the kind of the basic wiring pattern is laid out. And then I've talked about development as if it stops at birth, but that's of course not the case. Development
right.
continues after birth. So in the nervous system, in our brains, the basic wiring is there at the time that a baby's born, but after that point, then all of the sensory information that's coming into the child through the various sensory modalities are shaping the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So the brain is growing and responding and changing in the light of experience.
Okay.
So what makes your brain work is a combination of the basic pattern that it's given, which is then edited in a way that as you explore the environment that you're growing up and living in, that shapes the final brain. And obviously in the case of a human child, that takes a very, very long time for that to happen. And I've forgotten what the question was.
So what was the difference between a human organoid, or I'm sorry, a brain organoid and a human brain?
Okay.
And so one of the things that it seems like you're starting to lay out here is, well, a human brain, like once it's born, then it starts developing in a different way based on the experiences
exactly.
it has.
Yes.
Whereas a brain organoid, it's not having any experiences or...
Exactly.
So
a brain organoid. So, I mean, I think sometimes there's a tendency for people to think of a brain organoid as like a miniature brain.
Right. That's definitely how I thought about when we first encountered your work.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's not really a miniature brain. What it is it's analogous to a small part of the embryonic developing brain.
Okay.
In most cases, the cerebral cortex. So, for example, in the normal brain, in the cerebral cortex, there's two types of neurons. So we've got excitatory ones that give a positive signal, inhibitory ones that give a negative signal. And for those to assemble into a circuit and for the cortex to work, you've got to have both of those. And during embryogenesis, they actually arise in different parts of the embryo. So the cortex ones form in the back part, and the GABAergic, the inhibitory ones, form in the more ventral part. And then they move up and they form the connections.
Okay.
So when we grow an organoid, ordinarily, there are just the excitatory cells in it, right? So it's making cortex, but it's making cortex that's only got the excitatory cells. So it's missing these other neuron types, which in the embryo would normally, they would be born nearby and they would migrate in.
Okay.
And at later stages, it's also missing innervation. So the whole thing's about innervation and the formation of connections. So the cortex will become innervated. I mentioned the thalamus early on.
Mm-hmm.
So the thalamus processes sensory information. It's got a huge bundle of millions of axons that it sends off up into the cortex, and the cortex sends axons back and so on. And that passes and processes all of the sensory information from our environment. So that's not there in
okay.
the algorithm, because the thalamus is not there, so it can't make these connections. So it's like a rudiment of a particular part of the brain. It's not a miniature whole brain.
Sure. Okay. That's really helpful, because like I said, when I first encountered this, I was like, they're just growing little miniature brains. What's going on here? Okay. So I want to move on to something slightly different here. So earlier we talked about the limited amount of time that you can grow an organoid in a dish. And the main problem is that after a certain size, the brain needs blood vessels to sustain its growth. So since you want to study how the brain develops, you need to find a way to keep it growing. Now, in 2018, there was these scientists, they transplanted some human organoids into rats. And this allowed the organoid to be, I guess, fed by the blood of the animal so it can continue to develop. Now, as a non-scientist, I don't know, I just find this really creepy, because it just kind of feels like you're growing these human body parts in rats. And so maybe you could explain how this is an advantage for science, and maybe that'll help you feel a bit less creepy about this.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
So the reason behind the experiment is exactly as you say, is that again, there are many differences between organoids and actual brains, but probably one of the key differences is the absence of a blood supply. So the
okay.
absence of many other cell types which would ordinarily be present mm-hmm. in a brain. And if a piece of tissue is going to grow to more than about a millimetre in diameter, it has to have a blood supply or it will die.
Mm-hmm.
So we're able to keep these things artificially alive, as I say, by sort of shaking them and giving them very favourable nutrient conditions, but that has limits.
Okay.
So it will come to a point where the cells in the centre of the organoid will start to die. So this experiment was an attempt to try to get around that by transplanting an already formed organoid into either a mouse or a rat brain, with the idea that the blood vessels from the mouse or the rat would penetrate into the organoid and it would give it a vascular supply that would compensate for the absence of its own vascularity, as it were. So I suppose So from a biological viewpoint, I'm thinking of that as we're taking a clump of cells that we've got in a dish and we're transplanting them into a mouse or a rat brain mm-hmm. in order to try to get them to develop a bit further. So I suppose what I would ask is, what is it about that experiment that makes it feel a bit creepy?
Right. So I guess, so one thing is, we're here in Edinburgh, which is kind of the birthplace of the Frankenstein story, you know? And some of the things you're describing feel a bit like the Frankenstein story. So that might be part of the creep factor, but you know, I can just say, well, look, that's a very elaborate sort of creature that Frankenstein's trying to make, right? And that's not what you're up to. So I think it might be just the worry I have related to science fiction stories. But you're doing such a limited experiment compared to trying to create, I guess,
right.
I guess he wasn't trying to create a monster, but yeah. Yeah.
So I suppose so often transplantation is not an uncommonly used technique.
Mm-hmm.
So people have done things in the past where you would transplant, I think you referred to this actually earlier in one of your earlier mm-hmm. questions, where you transplanted neural progenitors from humans into mouse brains and
right.
they will develop into human neurons within a mouse brain. Relatively small numbers of them, but for does that have the same kind of creep factor to it? Or
it does. Several years ago, I would have said yes. Now, maybe because I'm more familiar with the idea, but originally the idea of just I'm growing human body parts in other animals, that's just bizarre. What is going on here? But I guess, I don't know. This is kind of the history of science, though, right? Is new ideas come up, people are very uncomfortable with them, and then at some point you just kind of get used to it, and it's no big deal. You don't bat an eye at it. So I don't know if that's maybe some of the sort of gut reaction I'm having to this, so going, this is unnatural, but a lot of the things we do.
Yeah, a lot of things in science are unnatural.
Right.
So that's kind of what I'm trying to find
right.
out, is what the source mm-hmm. of the creep factor is.
So I think, the unnaturalness is the thing. So seeing a documentary where there's a mouse walking around and has an ear growing out of its side, that's weird. But I know that's not entirely what you're up to. But the unnaturalness, I guess, it would eventually goes away when I start seeing, well, here are the scientific benefits of it, and here's the benefits for culture and humanity. Because I just get used to it. And so at some point, I see a mouse walking around with an ear popping out of it.
I mean, I can't remember the details of that particular mm-hmm. experiment, but I think that was misunderstood. I think.
Okay.
No, we weren't trying to, whoever was doing that experiment, they weren't trying to grow human ears in mice. It was, I really can't remember the deal exactly how that came about. But.
And I would have been a kid when I saw this too on TV, and so I was just like, what horrors are these going on?
It's a very striking image, actually. But
yeah.
I mean, people are growing, there are groups in California and other places who are trying to grow human organs in pigs for mm-hmm. transplantation, for example.
Right.
And I suppose if you, I mean, not that I know a huge amount about that kind of work, but if you imagine, you know, there are hospital wards full of people with failed kidneys who have been
right.
kept alive by dialysis, which mm-hmm. is, you know, time consuming, expensive, and very, very life limiting. And they will only survive if they're able to get a transplant. And there's an enormous shortage of suitable organs for transplantation. So I think, you know, if you're one of these people, then you're probably going to have fewer qualms about the idea of growing.
Right.
You know, we're happy to grow animals for meat and mm-hmm. peel them and eat them and
right.
so on. But why is it different to be growing a piece of tissue that happens to be from human cells?
Right. And so that's where I think where a lot of the creep, well, I guess I would, if I was in that sort of situation where I needed some sort of organ transplant, any sort of creepiness I would have about you're growing that in a pig, that would go away really fast, because I would see this as, well, this is really useful to me as a person. So I guess, again, is this common story of the history of science is people being very unsettled by the somewhat unnaturalness of what scientists are up to, and then eventually going, meh, all right, well, it's fine now, no big deal. So, I don't know. So I've got this other thing, though, that's kind of fascinated me here that I want to talk to you about. So when we were doing some of the research for the episode, we saw that in 2017, scientists took organoids, basically to the next level. And so there's a thing called an assembloid, and this is where you take, a brain region-specific organoid, like a hippocampus or an amygdala, and then you assemble them together. And it seems like you could even assemble these organoids together with other cell types, like a spinal cord. So is the ultimate goal to recreate a whole nervous system? Like, what's going on here?
No, so you wouldn't do something like that to try to recreate a whole nervous system. I'm not sure there's anyone who's sort of trying to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So we work with assembloids, and the logic behind the assembloids is an extension of the limitations of the organoid culture system.
Mm-hmm.
So if you, as I said, it's relatively straightforward to make cortical organoids. The cortex is involved in processing sensory information that comes to the cortex from the thalamus. So we're trying to make cortex organoids and thalamus organoids, and then we're going to put them together and look at the study how the connections form between the two. And the reason that we're doing that is because in patients or in people affected by autism, often they have a hypersensitivity to sensory stimuli.
Oh, right.
So they overreact, or they respond in a much more sensitive way to sensory stimuli than unaffected people might.
Mm-hmm.
So one possible explanation underlying that is that there's something not normal in the way that the thalamus and cortex are interconnecting between those. So because we now have genes which we know are mutated in people with autism, we can make the same mutation in either the cortical side or the thalamic side or both, and we can study the effect that that has on the formation of the pathway once we... We are, because the organoids as such are not really genuinely mini brains, they
right.
are lacking sections of the brain, that what we can do is to make region specific organoids and then try to recreate some of the local circuitry. So that's the type of question that we are trying to answer with those, and I think that's what most people are doing that type of thing are. So I'm not sure what the reason would be, you know, all of the things that we're doing, we're mm-hmm. trying to address a specific question or to understand a mechanism or a
right.
biological process. So it's not a case of we're trying to make a whole brain or a whole nervous system in,
right.
in addition. I mean, that would be an enormous technical challenge.
Sure.
But it's not really the aim of certainly of our work.
Okay, so there's no Dr. Frankenstein's here.
No.
Okay, so you guys are just really trying to do very specific things. So you have these limits mm-hmm. in the different models that you're creating. Well, what's a way to overcome that limit by bringing some of these pieces together to understand more of the mechanisms
to understand
play.
What happens with the connections and how the connections mm-hmm. normally form. And,
right.
And as I say, to some extent, you can model that, and people have done this, model that in animal mm-hmm. models, in rodents primarily. But that's never going to be quite the same as it is with humans. So it's better to be trying to do this in human. We now can do this with human tissue mm-hmm. for the first time, because we can grow this embryonic tissue from stem cells.
Right. Okay. So at this point, I've got, I guess, some metaphysical and some ethical questions that I want to raise to you. So you have this brain organoid in a dish, and maybe you put it in a mouse, and so you can make it grow a little bit more. At what point does this brain organoid become conscious?
So I Well, first of all, maybe you could define what you mean by conscious in this context.
Right, because there's a lot of different definitions of consciousness going around. So there's this one thing called phenomenal consciousness, which is the way philosophers put it is there's something that it's like to have this experience. So there's something that it's like to eat a delectable cheeseburger. And so that's my phenomenal conscious state.
Right.
So a conscious thing would be something that would have these states. They would have experiences. There would be something that it's like to be that thing.
Yeah.
And to have deep cheeseburgers or what have you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So certainly organoids as they are at present are like a million miles from that kind of... What organoids are very good at, I think, is looking at early stages of development. So when the progenitor cells are there, when the first neurons and so on are being born. So I'm excited by them because I think it's a really good tool to allow us to address questions that we haven't really been able to look at before.
Mm-hmm.
In humans. But the idea of these blobs of semi-organized tissue having something resembling consciousness is just, it really is like a million miles from that. You can allow them to develop a bit longer and they will form neurons and the neurons will make connections and you'll see kind of electrical activity. But I think, again, that's very, very, very far removed from the very highly organized patterns of electrical activity and connections between neurons and so on that you need in a brain for it, in order to have a property as sophisticated as consciousness.
Right.
So
really,
these things are very, very, very far removed from that point.
Okay. So is this somewhat related? Because you mentioned earlier there's different pieces that a brain organoid does not have that a brain has. So do you think that's part of the story of why they would not have consciousness?
So consciousness... you know, I'm not really a neuroscientist.
Sure.
Consciousness is very far removed from my area of expertise. But these higher functions of a brain are only going to emerge once all of the appropriate connections are made. So it's all about the connectivity. And with the organoids as they are at present, particularly, you don't have a cortex and a thalamus and a midbrain and a cerebellum and all these different parts of the brain which are interconnected together. And even within the cortex... So I mentioned before that the cortical tissue that people make has the excitatory neurons, but it lacks the inhibitory neurons unless you do something like an assembloid type of approach in order to restore that. So they have resemblance to embryonic brain, but they are very far removed from the type of very highly organized, fantastically highly organized structure that you would need to have in order to have something as sophisticated as consciousness. They really are a long way from that.
Okay. So I want to move now to an ethical concern. So when we were doing some of the research for the show, we found this thing in 2017. There was this Arlotta group from Harvard, and they published a paper in Nature where the neural activity of the organoids could be controlled using light. And so this means that the organoid is, I guess, well, responding to external stimulus, which suggests that it has the potential to experience sensations such as pain. So do you think this would be an ethical concern for future research on brain organoids, or do you think there should be, I don't know, maybe some limits on that we should put in place for our future research?
Yeah, so I think that's a nice experiment, and it's just showing, so people are trying to look at the emergence of electrical properties in organoids with a view to studying circuitry with them. And again, as I say, our work is more focused on earlier stages before these kind of properties are arising, but other people are looking at that. So do I think it's an ethical concern? I mean, I think organoids as they exist at present, unless we're doing something very artificial like that to them, are not really receiving sensory information. So we have to make some kind of connection that would allow them to do that.
Okay.
And then I think my answer to that would be the same as the answer to the last question, which is that the organoids are insufficiently close to a real brain to be processing that and in any way that would allow you to say it was experiencing pain or experiencing the sensation of light or any of these sensations in the way that we, with our very sophisticated human brains, would perceive them. So I think the organoids are just really very, very far removed from that. So it's electrical activity, but it's like electrical noise rather than highly organized patterns of activity that will give you things like consciousness and pain perception and these types of more sophisticated things. I think the question about putting limits on research is an interesting one, and I think often this is a good time to be thinking about this when it's in the early stages, mm-hmm. and how what kind of directions this research might end up going in 10 years or 20 years' time. And I suppose there's kind of a couple of ways of looking at that. You could think, well, what's the point in spending a lot of time worrying about something that might never happen?
Sure.
Or these very sophisticated arguments.
Yeah.
Because these organoids might never get beyond this type of rudiment because of the inherent limitations.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an early stage and they will get better, but we you know, I don't think we're ever going to be growing, we're certainly never going to be growing things like functional human brains in dishes.
Okay.
For the reasons that I've said. But it is possible that you could get more sophisticated structures, and we should be thinking, I think people are actually thinking about the potential ethical constraints. So if what consciousness were to emerge, would we be able to recognise it, and what should we
do about it? Yeah.
So I think at present there's nothing to worry about, but I think that going forward it's always conceivable, and it's something that people should bear in mind. I also think it's slightly interesting, very interesting, that... you know, some of the ethical issues that are facing science just now is, to my mind, is like germline genome engineering and so mm-hmm. on. And the technology is here now to do that, and the potential for that is enormous. And that's been a theoretical possibility for decades, and people haven't really grasped the nettle about should we be coming up with an ethical or moral framework for regulating this kind of research until it comes to the point that people are doing it.
Yeah.
And there doesn't seem to be a way of... You know, there is no regulation there, really.
Right.
I think what that needs is something like the Warnock Commission that we had back in the 70s that came up with a set of rules of philosophers and scientists mm-hmm. worked together to come up with something. So perhaps in the fullness of time, mm-hmm. if organoids continue to develop, then that would be a useful thing to do. But as it stands, these things are really very, very far removed from sophisticated complex nervous systems. They're rudimentary mm-hmm. tissues resembling parts of the embryonic nervous system.
So a lot of the ethical concerns I would have about human brains, they just don't apply here.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. Well, John, this was very fascinating. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you.
And there you have it, another episode of the Reluctant Theologian Podcast. Stay tuned for more episodes on consciousness, artificial intelligence, and so much more.